Four Things is an awe-striking visual feast that satisfies the eyes, tantalizes the loins, and feeds the soul. That's Christy Puchko of Mashable talking about Poor Things. That's right. I saw it a couple weeks ago. Cannot wait to discuss it. I wanted to wait until it's closer to its release so more of you will see it. So it's coming out December 8th, and it's bonkers. That's all I can tell you. It's fantastic. We're talking about Yorgos Lanthimos' new film. In addition to that, currently available in, I think, select theaters, and it'll be available widespread in Netflix soon. That's May, December. That's also some awards bait. Julianne Moore, Natalie Portman stars in that. The film that won the Palme d'Or at the Cannes Film Festival, Anatomy of a Fall, that's currently available in theaters, limited release, and available on Max. Right now, you can watch it. Albert Brooks, Defending My Life, which I loved. So three movies and one documentary this week here on Cinephile. And even more to that, our wild card is the author of a terrific new book. Scott Iman is his name, and it's a book about Charlie Chaplin. You're saying to yourself, why do I care about Charlie Chaplin? But you're going to enjoy this interview.
It gets nasty.
Yeah, absolutely. We got the salacious details. Charlie Chaplin versus America, when art, sex, and politics collided. As always, thanks for supporting the podcast. Please go to Apple Podcasts, where you can subscribe, rate, and review. And next week on the podcast, Lisa Cortez, who's Oscar-nominated, Emmy-winning producer, director. She made Little Richard, I Am Everything, which is available on Max on Thanksgiving. I reviewed it months ago. Excellent documentary. And you can look forward to Lisa's interview next week. Speaking of Apple Podcasts, I just went and took a quick look, Cody. And I believe this is our 300th episode. The reason I mention is I just went to Cinephile and it says, whatever, the bio for a few minutes says, see all, and then in parentheses, 299 more. So I don't know for certain. I didn't fact check this. Maybe Apple Podcasts is leading us askew, but this may be our 300th podcast.
That's impressive, man. I mean, I know I've only been around for what, half of it, a little less than half. You,
yeah,
you've been going, man. Like, this is like, that is no small feat. 300 is no joke.
I appreciate it, man. We've been together for a year and a half now, signed up last June. And so it's a weekly episode. If you do the math, yeah, we've been together for at least 75, 80, which has been a great run. And we'll continue more, at least up until my contract's up next June. So fingers crossed we keep going. It's funny when you say to somebody 300 episodes, that feels pretty good. What's the number that you say to somebody that stands out? Like if you're talking to your brother and you go, Adnan Burke's a film critic. He goes, whatever. He goes, well, he did Cinephile. What's the number? He goes, wait, he did 500 episodes? He did 1,000 episodes? He did 100 episodes? What's the number that gets someone's attention?
I think 200 means you've been around a good amount. Like, I think 100 is just anyone can do that. It says, I've heard people say it takes like 40 to 50 episodes for a podcast to like find a voice, like to really figure out what it is. So, I mean, yeah, I'd say 200 is a number.
200 is a good number. We're at 300, so that means we're definitely rolling. The number one question I'm often asked, people ask me as a film critic, the number one question I always get is, how many movies do you watch a week? And the answer is it varies. They go, I'll be specific. And I'm like, okay, it's 2 to 4. You know, in July, when it's some crappy Marvel movie, I force myself and I pay $97 to go see it. And I'll see one movie streaming or, you know, Lawrence of Arabia, I'll watch. But then award season, like now, 4 movies I'm cranking out. Next week, we have 4 movies, 5 movies. So generally, I'd say 2 to 4 movies. That's generally my answer. How many movies I watch a week? The next question often becomes, you know, how much prep goes into it? And I'm like, not a whole lot. They're like, what do you mean? I'm like, I go to the movies. I think, do you have a different notebook? I'm like, no, I just watch the movie. Do you write notes afterwards? I'm like, no, I just think about the movie and, you know, kind of go from there. And Chris sends me a list of some blurbs that he picks out. We got the cast and that kind of information. And the reason why is someone once asked me, they go, I'd love to be an intern for Cinephile. And I said, if I can help you with the prep work. And I go, there's really only one thing you could do, which came up this past week. Because the third question is, how often do you read other reviews? And the answer is, I used to be a pretty avid reader of reviews. And then something happened. And you're saying, what, you got too good for that? You're arrogant? Your social media?
I bet I know.
Okay, take
a guess. You started feeling yourself stealing stuff.
Well, that's part of it too. You're right. So then I said, you know what? If I'm going to see a movie, I don't need to see the reviews. All I'll see is the Rotten Tomatoes. So A Killers of the Flower Moon, I'm going to watch no matter. You signed me up years ago, months ago when they first announced it. So all I saw was 93% Rotten Tomatoes. And I know the critics love it. That's it. I don't need anything more than that. But what I like to do is, to your point, I like to go back and just curious. Hey, was I in line with other people are saying? Do I disagree with people are saying? And go from there. So but for specifically for Killers of the Flower Moon, I had not read the reviews. And I said, okay, let me get through it. So I start going through my favorite critics. You all know Tiber. I read him every week because I subscribe $5 a month to his newsletter. So I'll read his reviews. That's it. But Owen Gleiberman of Variety, I love, you know, the Hometown Papers, Globe and Mail, that kind of stuff. Ann Hornaday, Washington Post, Kirchner's favorite film critic. But there's a great critic named Manola Dargis, New York Times. So the other reason is, why have I stopped reading reviews? The paywall. If you go on Rotten Tomatoes, there's all these critics. And if you click on it, it's like, oh, subscribe to the Boston Globe, $1 for the next 6 months. I'm like, no, I'm not doing that. So if ever I needed an intern, it's for this specific reason. I need passwords to the major newspapers in America right now. And I would need you to print out that review, staple it, and leave it on my desk. That's the only reason we need an intern, Cody. Someone to go, can you just get the paywall for the New York Times, Boston, whatever it is, and just find seven reviews?
Expensive gig for the intern. So they have to now pay for all these things that you don't want to pay for just so you can have them. I mean, if you really want to make it in the industry, you got to do stuff like that sometimes.
Right. That's what I would do. I'm like, it's going to be going to work for me. It's going to cost you. What? How so? Sweat, blood, tears, hard work? No, money. It's going to cost you. Yeah, passwords. So I had to hook up my man, Dan Stanzik, because I know he's an avid New York Times guy. And I was like, hey, man, I'm trying to read Manola Dargis's review. He's like, yep. Like, he sent to me. He's like, yeah, phenomenal review. If you want to read a review of Killers of the Flower Moon, Manola Dargis published a few weeks ago. Excellent. If you have the paywall.
How did Stanzik feel about it?
I think he was okay about it. I just messaged him. Hey, I know you're a New York Times guy. Can you send to me? He's like, yeah, no problem. Happy to help. It's like sharing passwords, right? If you're sharing passwords, no big deal.
Yeah.
Anyways, we get to the topic at hand, which is you're really the way you want to experience a movie, which I was able to do with Poor Things, was I don't know any reviews. There's no buzz to it. I'm seeing it literally a month before it premieres. December 8th, it's available in theaters. And I was able to watch it November 8th. Took my wife to go see it. So first question, you're like, oh, I know. What about the phone issue? But this is what's great with the critic screening. Very serious. Everyone's got the plastic black glasses. They all wear black, drinking their coffees, their scarves, espressos. They've got notebooks. So I'm like, she can't take the phone out. Like they will, you'll be shamed by everybody around you if you take your phone out. So I'm like, this is a massive win. I really want to see this movie. I know she's going to be into it and she can't take her phone out. And thankfully she enjoyed it as much as I did. But
how do critics in this dark theater write down on so that, stuff?
100%. Excellent question. Because that's the thing. I'm like, why? I've done it before. Like when I think before I was a cinephile film critic,
I'm waiting for a lit scene and then I'm like holding it up. So I'm like using the light from the theater.
Oh, yeah. 100%. Like you're writing, but you don't really know what you're writing. And you're right. At least 30% of the time I'd go back and I'm like, I can't read this. Just a bunch of chicken scratch. I'm not really sure what this was. So it's better just to mentally comport what you're watching. But there definitely was critics. That guy from Robot, I remember he was writing and I was laughing. I'm like, oh, you have a notebook. He's like, well, I just bought a new one just for this movie, 3.5 hours. Jesus. And he's flipping pages over. So I found it amusing. A couple of times it took me out of the movie because I'm watching it and then peripherally I see him writing. I'm like, well, why is he writing about this scene? Like, what is it about this that he's capturing? But this seems like a fairly generic scene. But regardless, he was scribbling away furiously. So with Poor Things, it was so much fun because I go, all I know is it's crazy and it's from this guy who's a crazy director. And I say that with affection. And here's the story. The incredible tale about the fantastical evolution of Bella Baxter, a young woman brought back to life by the brilliant and unorthodox scientist, Dr. Godwin Baxter. Yorgos Lanthimos is the director. If you like your indie movies and crazy movies, you know who he is. He directed The Lobster, one of Ron Russillo's favorite movies. So I often cite to Russillo the scene where Colin Farrell is first going in to meet them. They say, what is your sexuality? And he's like, I'm bisexual. And they go, we don't have that option anymore. You're either heterosexual or homosexual. And the look on his face, Colin Farrell has to give like 12 seconds where he has to pause and mull over this important question. Eventually he's like, heterosexual. I'm like, all right. But The Lobster, there's also a scene with John C. Reilly. They put his hand in a toaster because he gets caught masturbating. Like, it's just a bizarre movie. The favorite, probably more of you have seen, that movie won Academy Award for Olivia Colman. That was a surprise win for Best Actress. But again, beautiful period piece, a sumptuous production design, clothing, etc. But then he's got some weird stuff going on. So Emma Stone reunites here with Yorgos Lanthimos. And the buzz has been she's going to be nominated for an Academy Award. And she may even win, maybe even the favorite. No pun intended. And the movie starts out, Willem Dafoe's face. And I love Willem Dafoe. Previous guest here in Cinephile. He was very gracious. Name checked me. Very nice guy. We talked Platoon, talked Autofocus, Affliction. But I've always been a little bit concerned looking at Willem Dafoe's face because I'm like, is he classically handsome or is he just kind of weird looking? Because he's got those high cheekbones and he's very skinny. And I'm like, I believe in that interview, he may have said, because I've always had a unique look. I'm like, yeah, like I think he's a good looking guy. He's Willem Dafoe. But I'm like,
great actor or weird?
Yeah, great actor or weird. You kind of go in that territory. And I think he's a great actor only because when I spoke to him, he seemed very down to earth, nice guy, but he could be a little bit weird. But in this movie, they make him look so weird. Quickly Google right now, Cody, Willem Dafoe as Dr. Godwin Baxter, Poor Things. You'll see this man's face. How horribly disfigured they made Willem Dafoe look. It was 6 hours in a makeup chair, and he said he was thrilled to do it. I listened to him on the podcast with a Smartless podcast. It was probably a couple months ago, actually. He briefly mentioned, because, no, I love this movie. Lanthimos is crazy. 6 hours of makeup. It looks demented. And you watch the movie, and you go, okay, so it's Frankenstein.
Holy shit. Yeah. Holy crap.
Like, he just looks deformed, right? It's just a disgusting
movie. What's going on with his chin?
Yeah, scarred and puffy. And so the character, he births Emma Stone. And the story showed us initially, Chris is now screen sharing with me. I mean, it is just a marvel. Scarred, puffy, chin protruding, just a horrifying look.
Just like a cross down the side of his face.
You're right. There's some sort of religious allegory here with that cross. Because Emma Stone, as the movie quickly shows, commits suicide. This is the prologue to it. Commits suicide, retrieves her body, and then he puts in another brain in her head. So this is Frankenstein. It's the brain of an infant is in her head. And so, like, you know, the movie starts out. Rami Youssef shows up. My man, love Rami. Would love to get him on the podcast. Love his show on Hulu. This is a big role for him. Like, man, dude, you're in a Yorgos Lanthimos movie. Pretty good. He shows up as Max McCandles, and he's here to investigate what's going on. So Dr. Godwin Baxter, who goes by the name of God. Maybe the cross does make sense. Emma Stone's Bella Baxter, she only calls him God. God, what should I do now? God, what can I do? God, am I allowed to do this? I'm like, okay, God, whatever you say. And he's got that crazy, you know, Transylvanian accent going as well. And it's bizarre because you see how she's like an infant. Like, the acting is incredible by Emma Stone because her movements, her motions, her voice, it's like that of a two-year-old, and yet it's in a human body. And there's one incredible scene where dance music starts playing, and you know, having seen La La Land, for which she won an Academy Award, that girl can dance, her and Ryan Gosling making sweet music together. So when she's dancing, she's not dancing perfectly. She's dancing like with some rhythm, but also as if it was a five-year-old child dancing. It's bizarre, to say the least. But Defoe is God. He's Frankenstein. And Rami Youssef is entranced. And he says to her at one point, I don't know if I can even repeat what he says, but he uses like an offensive term, but he's saying that she's beautiful. And God's like, yeah, no. He's like, oh, I'm falling for her. I'm like, what? Like, you're in love with this beautiful woman, but she's like the brain of a five-year-old. And then he says to a woman before, he's like, did you fuck her? He's like, what? He's like, I'm a eunuch. And he's like, what? He's like, I'm a eunuch. I can't fuck. He's like, we would need all the electricity in North London for me to even get an erection. I was howling. And the crowd was, it was a good crowd. Again, the critics, so we're all laughing our heads off the line. But Rami Youssef wants to marry her. He wants to control her. He's already fallen in love with her. And then Mark Ruffalo shows up, who's, again, one of my favorite actors. He's playing Duncan Wedderburn. And he is the character that, you know, of an earlier time, you'd refer to him as a cad. You know, you'd say he dresses like a dandy. He shows up. He's got the twirling mustache. Good looking guy. Got the hair. Dressed to the nines. Three-piece suit. Cigarette holder. I'm like, okay, this guy's bad news. But all the girls love him. Like, he is a charmer. He is a swindler. And he shows up and he seduces her and convinces her to leave God. So in the middle of the night, they go and they take off. And then the movie becomes a different story. So you think it's basically Frankenstein, but then it becomes a feminist tale, because as Bella gets older, she develops her own mind, her own brain, and she doesn't like being trapped by this guy, Duncan, who wants to marry her. And by the way, very graphic sex scenes. I was like, was not expecting Miss Stone to take this turn, but when Duncan is seducing her, they get after it in rather upfront detail. But again, she starts to develop a nudity? Mind out. Yeah, there's Emma definitely
Stone nudity.
Yeah, not quite like No Hard Feelings, which, you know, Reddit was able to hook us up with, because I was unable to see that.
I don't know how Reddit just, I don't know, it stumbled upon my phone. I don't know how it happened.
So now I know why she got paid the $25 million, Jennifer Lawrence. But anyways, Duncan wants to control her. You're my wife, you're going to do what I say. But he realizes, much like dealing with a child, she has a mind of her own. And so at one point they're up for dinner and she's ill-mannered. You know, she's making stupid comments. He's like, listen, you moron. Like, he takes her aside. Like, here's the things you're supposed to say. Here's what you're not supposed to say. But she doesn't know. She has the mind of an infant. And meantime, Rami Youssef is heartbroken because she's left him. She's out with Duncan. I will say no further, except the story becomes a real feminist tale. And eventually there is an extended sequence in a bordello, which not only very funny, but unforgettable. Like, once she realizes that she needs the money, and she's willing to have sex for money because she's just super horny, because now she's enjoying experience on this for this time. Like, there's one guy that gets on top of this French guy who's not quite an aristocrat like Ruffalo's character. Three thrusts and he's done. And she just bursts out laughing. Can't wait to take this guy's money. Another guy, an unforgettable scene, has like his son there. And while he's doing stuff to Emma Stone, he's like doing narration. He's telling his son in French, look what I'm doing now. Like I said, the movie's bonkers, but I loved it. I thought it was brilliant. It's really funny. And I think makes a lot of smart points. That's probably the best way I could describe it. It's Dr. Frankenstein in a feminist tale. It's very opulent. The production design is amazing. Even the way he shoots it, Lanthimos is such a visionary director. He gives it that style of like a movie from like the 1920s at times. Like it feels like one of these gothic horror movies, you know, like a F.W. Murnau picture. And he's balancing all these different genres. And at times, you feel like you're watching Cabinet of Dr. Caligari. It's in black and white, then it's in color. Haunting score. The music's fantastic. It's got this kind of impish flavor to it. So it's really a movie that I think people are really going to enjoy. I'll give it 3.5 Maple Leafs. My wife went 3 Maple Leafs. She said it was a little long, a little too much sex for her Puritan views. But I think people are really going to enjoy it. And make sure you check out Poor Things. Oscars will be showering their riches upon them, I think, as far as nominations are concerned. Best director, best picture, best actress. And I hopefully a couple of best supporting actor nods for Ruffalo and Willem Dafoe. Both those guys are terrific.
Color me intrigued.
Yeah, you're definitely going to be wanting to watch them, Poor Things. It's going to have a lot of buzz at the water cooler. Next up, May, December on Netflix, I believe very soon. Limited theaters right now. Synopsis is, 20 years after the notorious tabloid romance gripped the nation, a married couple buckles under pressure when an actress arrives to do research for a film about their past. It's from director Todd Haynes, whose film Far From Heaven, I think, is just a gorgeous film. It's a real throwback and homage to the Douglas Sirk movies about the 1950s, those women's pictures, melodramas, etc. So he's got a really fantastic eye. He also did I'm Not There, which I could see Mike Ryan liking. It's a movie about Bob Dylan with like seven different people playing Bob Dylan, including Cate Blanchett. I wasn't as enamored of that picture, but he's certainly a very talented director. When you hear a Todd Haynes movie's coming, you know it's going to be important. And it's got the pedigree of Natalie Portman and Julianne Moore. Portman plays Elizabeth. She's the actress coming in. They're going to make a TV movie about Julianne Moore's life. She plays Gracie. And why is it so interesting? Because Julianne Moore, as Gracie, when she was 36 years of age, married with kids, had an affair with a student, ended up marrying the student, and ostracized herself from her community and her children, not to mention her ex-husband. The question you're asking, Cody, how old was the student?
Yeah.
Now, this is, I think, it's a little bit ripped from the headlines here. I think the actor, the real person is Mary Kay Letourneau, if I'm not mistaken, also very famously was a middle, you know, not middle age, but mid-30s female, had sex with one of her students in an affair and became a real cause celebre. At one point, they say, when he kind of comes to reckoning what's gone through his life, Charles Melton, by the way, is the actor playing Joe Yu, who's very good. He says he was in seventh grade. So I quickly do the math. I'm like 36 and 12. At another point, he gets angry. He says, I'm 13. And I was like, okay.
36 and 13.
No, I read another review where someone says he's 14. And I'm like, I've never heard of a 14-year-old in seventh grade. I watched the film. They specifically said seventh grade.
That's also not much better. Like, I love how it's like, oh, if he's 14, it's all okay.
Like, imagine if you're a grown man, 30s. I mean, you're 34?
Six.
36. It's perfect. This is great. 36-year-old man. If you had an affair with a student, it's game over for Chris Cody. See ya. You're never seeing him again. Like, it's been a nice life, and that's it. What happened to Cody? He's been canceled. He had an affair with a seventh grader. Like, what?
Let's not isolate that audio. There's context there.
So similarly, just imagine, like, you're a 36-year-old man. You have 36-year-old friends. Imagine you must know a girl who's a school teacher, and she tells you, I had an affair with a seventh grader. Full stop. Mic drop. He's 13. I'm going to marry him. She ended up going to prison. And what was so fascinating is you see Natalie Portman as an actress doing her homework. She's investigating the story. She talks to the ex-husband, who, by the way, fascinating character. Like, wait, what was it like when you found out your wife, who moved you have kids with, is having sex with a 13-year-old? They were discovered in a pet store. So Natalie Portman goes to the pet store and goes, can I take a look? And it's like, yeah. She goes in the back, starts playing with herself. Like, she's trying to relive the moment. I'm like, oh my God, you're a grown woman and you want to get into character. Like, I love what Todd Haynes is making a point about actors is that they're parasites. They're just looking to suck the blood out of everything around them, right? She's a method actress. I want to know everything. I don't care about any of you. I just want to suck the blood away and give a great performance and win an Academy Award. At one point, you see her talking to her husband, whatever. She's like, oh, the movie's going okay, but she's really getting into the character. But the ex-husband was like, you know, what do you think? I ruined my life. Like, I wasn't expecting this. And he goes, what was so crazy about Gracie was she didn't understand what was wrong with it. Like, she knew she had an affair, but she was kind of like, I'm in love. It is what it is. I'm like, but you're a pedophile. Like, you're going to prison. Like, this isn't like, well, you know, I'm leaving my husband and my kids. Like, no, you're going to prison. You know, you slept with a teenage boy. So she goes
just
to prison.
Mind's warped about it.
Oh, ugh. Yeah. Ends up going to prison, has a kid with this now second husband. And at one point, Natalie Portman makes a joke to the guy, like, hey, like, we're around the same age. Like, I'm 36 and you have a kid who's like 19. How crazy is that? He's like, yeah. And you can start to see where the story's going. Definitely an homage to Ingmar Bergman's Persona as these two characters kind of mesh together. At one point, they're both looking in the mirror together doing their makeup. You go, okay, I see what he's going here. He's making a point about identity and about how this actress is clearly a parasite. She's sucking the marrow of this person's life. But she also sucked away her own life, meaning Gracie. Like she maybe she was a predator. Maybe she took advantage of this 13-year-old boy who didn't know where he was. He wasn't able to make decisions the way a grown adult would. And so was she also culpable of taking advantage of somebody and, as I said, sucking away the life out of him? It's a fascinating subject. The movie is very interesting. I give it 3 Maple Leafs. I encourage people to check it out. The story definitely takes some turns I wasn't expecting. I was expecting a big twist at the end, kind of like my criticism of whatever the hell I reviewed, The Killer, I think, kind of the anticlimactic ending. I was expecting a little more for the ending, but definitely provocative subject matter. It's the kind of thing where if you told me there's a documentary, I'm sure there is. There's got to be a doc out there about Mary Kay Letourneau. I think that's her name, who actually lived this life. It would be fascinating to see, like, what exactly was your thought process that you thought you could do this and it would be acceptable within society? But terrific performances. Julianne Moore might get a Best Supporting Actress nomination. Natalie Portman, always terrific, might be a Best Actress nominee. Todd Haynes' film, it's called May December. It's currently available on Netflix.
Now, I'm about to ask something very stupid because you said something in all that, and I was like, wait, did he mean that? Like, Natalie Portman, when studying for the role, went into this thing and...
No, that's my fault because I'm saying that part. I was just saying Elizabeth. So she's playing Elizabeth,
okay,
who's an actress.
Her character,
so the character
went in. Okay.
Of Elizabeth is
the
going.
The way you painted that, it was like, yeah, when Natalie was preparing for the role, she went into the back and was like, I got to just get in character. I was like, whoa.
Yeah, no. Elizabeth, okay, as the character. But you're right. On set, it must be interesting because at times you can see Natalie Portman is like mimicking Julianne Moore's moments. And Ty Burr, in his terrific review, talked about Rachel McAdams in Spotlight. She's playing a journalist of the Boston Globe, and the actual journalist told Ty Burr, she goes, it was really weird. At one point, I was talking to Rachel McAdams, and I noticed she slowed down her walk, and she was studying how I was walking. It was so creepy.
That's funny.
Like, then there's great stories, obviously. Pacino's my guy. Pacino, when he played Serpico, he said it was incredible. Like, they say, do you ever want to meet the actor? He's like, oh, absolutely. The real person? Oh, yeah. He goes, Frank Serpico, I hung out for like months. He's like, we would go up for beers, go up for drinks. I wanted to know everything about it. But then to that parasitic point, when the movie was over, Serpico was crushed. He's like, oh, Pacino, stop calling me. Sidney Lumet, stop calling me. The director's like, what do you mean? Like, the job is done now. Like, we're good.
On to the next.
Yeah. I thought we were buddies. I'm like, well, we are, but we're done. Like, thanks for everything. The movie's awesome. Dude, it's an iconic movie. Serpico, it's you. I did it for you. Now we're done. We move on. We move on as well with our reviews. Anatomy of a Fall. Palme d'Or winner. A woman is suspected of her husband's murder and their blind son faces a moral dilemma as the main witness. Yeah, good subject matter, huh? You hear that story, you go, oh my God. Sandra Hüller plays the main actress. I believe she also received plaudits at the Cannes Film Festival. She could be in line for Best Actress nominee. Courtroom drama. I thought it was very well done. A little long, 2.5 hours, but it builds up to that moment. Who's guilty? Who's not guilty? Because all that we know is a tragic accident happens. Apparently her husband falls from their house. Did she push him? Was he pushed? Did he fall, et cetera? That's why it's called Anatomy of a Fall. So it becomes a courtroom thriller. And what's fascinating about it is you're tempted to think along with the rest of the jury, did she or didn't she? Did she kill her husband? Did he not? Was it an accident? Did he fall on his own, et cetera? And the story gets in the murky details. And where the story really starts to be gripping is an hour and a half in, they do a flashback of a fight that her and her husband had the day before. Fantastic. And she's not painting an image of them having a perfect marriage. She's saying that we had some issues, but I would never kill my husband. Like, he fell. That's it. And their son, here's the big wrinkle, is blind. So he was down there and he, you know, obviously did not see his father fall, but was aware of the situation, could hear something that happened. And so at one point, they're trying to replicate the situation because the husband loved loud music. So it was very, very soothing. But it's a sample from 50 Cent. It's PIMP. So it's an instrumental version. So this is amazing scene, like just blasting, blaring PIMP instrumental version. And they're trying to replicate going, okay, could you in this moment be able to hear if your mom hit him, fell, like what exactly was happening? And again, I'm no expert on these things, but clearly when people have said if they're lacking one sense, their other senses become heightened. I know this from watching Scent of a Woman. So because Pacino can't see, his sense of smell is incredible. He can smell the perfume of every woman. You know, your hearing is heightened. So if the boy's hearing is heightened, or at least he hopes. But that flashback is so good because it ends up really giving a lot of murkiness to the character.
I don't know. I thought
if anybody can hear that, that's P-I-M-P. It's great. But it's almost, it is that instrumental, but like it's even like, I don't know, it's like a European version of it. Like it's a little bit more blaring. It's like got some classical notes to it, but it's great. But you hear that song in this movie, like you can't watch me and not think of that song now. I'm like, oh my God, every time I'm going to hear this song, it's whack. But again, Sandra Hüller, terrific performance. And the movie really hinges on, did she or didn't she? And it's not at least one of those movies which is open-ended. Again, I will not give away the ending. I will just say simply that there is a resolution. You know, part of me was thinking this is like one of these, you know, thrillers from the 90s, like Basic Instinct. Did she or didn't she? And then you think she's okay with Michael Douglas. And all of a sudden, boom, last shot, ice pick. Joe Esterhaas, Paul Verhoeven, mic drop. I'm not going to spoil the ending. I will simply say that there is a resolution and it's an excellent movie. I'm giving it 3 Maple Leafs, Anatomy of a Fall, courtroom thriller. Lastly, before we get to our special guest, Scott Eyman, Albert Brooks, Defending My Life. One of my favorite movies of the year, 4 Maple Leafs. A documentary about the comedian and filmmaker Albert Brooks, which includes interviews from Sharon Stone, Larry David, James L. Brooks, Conan O'Brien, Sarah Silverman, and Jonah Hill. And my biggest criticism of this, even as I give it 4 Maple Leafs, and it's one of my top 10 movies of the year, I wish it was longer. Only an hour and a half of Albert Brooks. The guy is so funny and clearly such an original filmmaker and such a big influence on others. I can't believe this is all they gave us. But the story is him and Rob Reiner hanging out. Rob Reiner and him are old high school buddies. They've been friends for 60 years. So he takes Albert Brooks out for dinner and they film it and they're telling stories. And both the sons of famous people, Albert Brooks' dad was a comedian and Rob Reiner, of course, his dad is Carl Reiner. And they tell early on, Carl Reiner, who's this, you know, legend of comedy, when he's on an interview, I think, I don't know what show it was, maybe Jack Parr, he goes, who's the funniest person you know? He goes, oh, my son Rob's friend Albert is like the funniest person I know. He's hysterical. And he goes, like, he was 16 years old. They're like, that's when you're like, wait, my dad thinks this guy's funny? And they show his old comedy routines, went on Carson 30 times. He was just so original in his comedy. It was just so unique what he was doing. And what I always appreciate with these documentaries is you have so many other talking heads. They're the ones that really make it. They're the ones that make it special. So if you and I are watching Albert Brooks on his own, yeah, it's certainly funny. But when you hear Judd Apatow is telling you, this is why it's so funny. This is why it's so influential. Larry David talking about certain routines he did. Conan O'Brien, Chris Rock, Ben Stiller is a huge fan of it. Sarah Silverman. Jonah Hill is a massive Albert Brooks guy. As you can understand, man, Albert Brooks, like, I grew up in this guy's comedy to actually get to meet him and know him a little bit. So it's a very affectionate and warm tribute. And it really wants me to go back and watch some of his movies. I've seen Lost in America, came out in 1985. Very funny. The title comes from, I think, his best film, which is Defending Your Life. This title is Defending My Life. And Rob asks him, you know, the story, how did you cast Meryl Streep? And he's like, I was just at a party. And she was like, oh, I'd love to work with you one day. And I'm like, well, you know, I've got this script. And she was like, I'm in. And I'm like, this is Meryl Streep. This is the greatest actress ever. You're in? He's like, yeah, I love your work. Whatever it is, go ahead, I'm in. So that's how he cast Meryl Streep as the female lead this movie. And it's really funny. Rip Torn is excellent playing the defense attorney, if you haven't seen it. It's about a guy who dies. And what happens when you die is they have a court case. And Rip Torn is representing him. He's telling him, you know, you only use 4% of your brain. I use 48%. And they have a trial. And your life goes, you watch scenes of your life. And you go, okay, remember what happened here? You should have made a better decision here. This wasn't great. This is one of your guilt, one of your regrets. It's a brilliant movie because it's funny, but also very smart and very provocative. And Rob Reiner asks Albert Brooks, hey, what do you think is going to happen when you die? What do you think heaven is like? But the guy is hysterical. Most recently, I think people saw him in Curb Your Enthusiasm, where he was outed as a COVID hoarder. Larry David tells a story. He says, well, of course, his brother, Bob Einstein, Super Dave, no longer with us. And that's the thing too. Albert Brooks, his real name is Albert Einstein. And Rob Reiner said to me, he's like, how many people do you think know that? And he goes, I feel like people used to really know that about me. I know they didn't know it. And now some people kind of do know it. He's like, but the point is this, I'm the one of four boys. And my dad had three chances being an Einstein to go with Albert, but he chose me. He could have, any of my three brothers, he went with Bob or whatever. He's like, no, my last kid, I'm calling him Albert. He's going by Albert Einstein. He goes, but then eventually I changed it to Albert Brooks. But yeah, I mean, if they have like the high school yearbook photos, Albert Einstein. Just imagine the pressure, Cody, being known as Albert Einstein. And you're a comedian.
No.
Too much.
I don't want that. Yeah, I don't want that.
I didn't know any of the stuff about his dad. His dad died on stage. Fascinating story. It was at a roast. They were doing a roast and he said his dad up there killed. Did like a great 10 minutes, went back to his chair and died. That's
killed.
Literally died. And he said
he killed and then killed.
Yeah, exactly. He killed them with them killed. And like they were like, well, the show must go on. And at one point that they asked some singer to go on there. And the song, Albert Brooks tells it so well. He goes, I think, I don't know, Jimmy Durante, whoever it is. He goes, they're telling, they go, sing, sing. And he goes, but the guy's most famous song was There'll Be No Tomorrow. He's like, this is the song playing. My dad has collapsed. There's a gurney. There's an ambulance. And there's this guy warbling. There'll be no tomorrow. Okay, thanks. Clearly fitting. But he said it definitely impacted his life. Because whenever I'm doing comedy and stuff, I'm like, thinking, like, my dad died in this state. But again, as a comedian, as an original thinker, as a provocateur, like when you hear Chris Rock talking about him, like, dude, there's been no one like Albert Brooks. And David Letterman at one point says, if I could have my career, Albert Brooks, I'd take Albert Brooks. He's like, wrote, produced, directed, starred in his movies. And his character parts, amazing. Broadcast News, which Levitard's a huge fan of. He and I have talked about. Albert Brooks was Academy Award nominated for that movie. Amazing. Like whenever people ask me about broadcasting, I'm like, watch Broadcast News, watch Albert Brooks. And the scene where he starts sweating, that's the most famous scene. He's a reporter. He gets to fill in for William Hurt. He goes, where did that come from? Rob Reiner asked him. And he said, I was watching CNN one night and I saw this guy get nervous. He started to sweat a little bit. And I called James L. Brooks and I go, I got it. When he does it, he goes, we're just going to have sweat pouring. He's just going to be just drenched. That's going to be the scene. And to this day, if you ever see somebody perspiring a little bit, looking uncomfortable on television, like, oh, man, it's hot here. Oh, man, going to have like an Albert Brooks moment in Broadcast News. Anybody who's smart will get the joke and get the reference. And I always laugh every time I hear it and every time I see that scene. Also, most recently, I think Jonah Hill mentioned, he goes, I love him in character parts. Like in Drive, he's fantastic. Ryan Gosling at one point, you know, he's all dirty. Albert Brooks extends his hand and he says, oh, my hands are dirty. Albert Brooks smiles and goes, so are mine. Great scene. Homicidal killer. And of course, why do I love Albert Brooks? As a comedian, what was his big breakthrough movie? Taxi Driver. And he's told the story many a time. He said, you know, Paul Schrader has said, actually, the writer of Taxi Driver, because it was so clever by Marty, because he's got De Niro, he's got Keitel, he's got Jodie Foster, who's 14 years old, playing a 12-year-old prostitute. He's got Cybill Shepherd. And he goes, this character is fairly bland. He's just a guy working for a politician, Charles Palantine. He goes, he cast a comedian. And he cast Albert Brooks. And Schrader's told the story. Albert Brooks went up to him. Schrader went up to him, sorry. After the movie, he goes, hey, thanks so much for your performance. Like, I couldn't figure out your character. But, like, you were the one that I couldn't crack. You were awesome. Albert Brooks looks at him and goes, so the character of a taxi driver who becomes a homicidal maniac, that you felt you could write. The child prostitute, you had no issues coming back to life. But a 9-to-5 guy working in a presidential office, that was the one you couldn't crack. He's like, oh my God, Paul Schrader's a demented man. But he said, I love Marty. He goes, he was so great to work with. He goes, Marty loves comedy and he loves comedians and he knew who I was. That's why he cast me. And he said, I would go to the set on the days that I wasn't shooting. I would just go just to watch De Niro. I would watch Marty direct. And he goes, it was a blast. And he goes, to this day, I have such warm feelings. And he goes, I never thought a film like Taxi Driver, I would have even a small part of. He said, that's what a great, great film it was. And later, The Muse, which is with Sharon Stone. There's an incredible Scorsese cameo. If you've never seen it, you don't have to watch the whole movie. But just look up Scorsese cameo in The Muse. Sharon Stone plays a muse who literally helps creative types get back their star power. So Albert Brooks goes to see her. He's like, how can I be a writer and stuff? But he's like, other people start showing up. James Cameron shows up. And at one point, she's giving him advice. And then Marty walks out. And Albert Brooks is like, but he's not playing Marty Scorsese. He's just playing a director. And he's like, I've got an idea for a movie. He's like, Do you want to hear it? He's like, yeah. He goes, it's about a guy. Because I'm doing a remake of Raging Bull. He's like, what? He goes, a sequel to Raging Bull. He's like, yeah. He goes, except this time the guy's really thin. He's like, what? He goes, he's really thin, but angry. Thin and angry. Thin and angry. Thin and angry. Do you see it? Do you see it? Albert Brooks is like, hey, I see it. He goes, do you see it? Thin and Angry, Raging Bull sequel. And he goes, you know, there's a Starbucks running and we're going to get coffee. Albert Brooks goes, I don't know. I think you've had your quota for today. He goes, quota. That gives you an idea for another different picture. We never spoke. I'll never see you again. Like, amazing. The fact that he cast Scorsese in The Muse to me is so funny. If you look up the clip, I just did it, but it'll be even funnier when you see Marty doing it with Albert Brooks.
No mention of The Scout.
No mention of The Scout. Sadly, you're right. That is an Albert Brooks classic. That was one of my other things, too, I'll get to in a second, looking for comedy in the Muslim world, which I love, which I don't think anyone's seen, probably five people have seen it. Like, they're not going to mention it, but they do mention it. I'll tell that story in just a second. I had something else I wanted to say. It was about Larry David. Larry David goes, I can tell when they're nervous. And he goes, Albert was kind of nervous that day on set. I was like, he's kind of nervous. Even he feels like this is a big deal. Like, I'm on curb. And of course, Bob Einstein, his brother, is incredible. Marty Funkhauser, who's now, of course, passed on. But Marty Funkhauser, amazing. But the fact he's a COVID hoarder on Curb, amazing. I wish they'd done more. Like, I remember when Albert Brooks was on them, like, oh my God, Albert Brooks is going to be on Curb. It was just the one episode. I wish he'd done more, but he was awesome. Looking for comedy in the Muslim world. He tells a story. He goes, you know, this is later in his career. It's tough to get funding. He goes, I can never get funding for my movies, right? Because I write them, I produce them, I direct them, and I star them. It's hard to get the funding. Eventually, we get the movie. And he goes, and then the cartoons happen, the Danish cartoons of the Prophet. And he goes, it's a big controversy. And the studio's like, listen, we can't release this movie. The title is Looking for Comedy in the Muslim World. And Albert Brooks goes, the whole point of the movie is the title. You can't take that out of the title. So because eventually, because we had like a financier from like J Date, they're like, we're going to do something new. How about no advertising for the movie? I'm like, what? And he goes, you've been in these pitch meetings. Like, it's a great idea. No TV advertising. We'll just release the movie. I'm like, great. The movie's going to tank. No one's going to see it. He goes, but I'll tell you this story. I'm at the Dubai Film Festival. And he goes, I'm up there with like the Sheikh and like still the women and stuff. And he goes, they're all on their phones. And I go, this sucks. I'm watching the movie. They're all on their phones. And he goes, but there's one part. I'm like, I want to see their reaction. And then they show the clip of the movie. So funny. The woman wearing the veil. And she's like, are you a Jew? And he's like, what's that? He goes, are you a Jew? And he's like, a little bit. And he's like, you are? He's like, some of the time. And she goes, how often? And he goes, part-time. he goes, just for that scene. As soon as she goes, are you a Jew? He goes, the guys all looked up. And he goes, when I said part-time, they're like, big laugh. Big laugh. Big laugh. My work here is done at the Dubai Film Festival. I love Albert Brooks. I love the movie. I want everyone to go check out Defending My Life for Maple Leafs for a guy who's obviously been a huge influence on movie. Come up blurbs here for you. John Anderson of Wall Street Journal, not the John Anderson of Sports Center. The time feels right for an Albert Brooks assessment, although one by Mr. Reiner was never going to be anything but glowing, and as it happens, convincing. Caleb Marsh of New York Times. While Brooks deserves acclaim, he deserves it in a format as compelling and dynamic as he is. Defending My Life is simply too flat. I mean, it's literally two guys having dinner. Dan Feinberg, Hollywood Reporter. It's hard not to feel like Brooks got a tiny bit shortchanged with merely a feature-length doc, one of which my primary complaint was, give me more. But an Albert Brooks documentary with an inferiority complex? Appropriate. A couple other blurbs here for you, and then we'll get to our featured guest, Anatomy of a Fall from Odie Henderson of Boston Globe. Trier, who's the director, approaches so many elements from slightly askew angles that bend just enough to support conflicting arguments. Keith Ulick, a clear and clean Palme d'Or winner, every ambiguity and unexpected choice so carefully thought through that awards can't help but be thrown at it. And Adam Graham of Detroit News. Trier's script, which she co-wrote with her IRL partner Arthur Harari, is always pushing forward, pulling and peeling back new layers as it goes, and going deep inside the fraught underlying tension of Sandra and Samuel's marriage. And May-December, my man Ty Burr. It's a little as if Bergman's persona had been remade by the Real Housewives of Savannah. Wendy Ide of Observer, Serpentine, it's plodding, queasily, unsettling in its subject matter, and very, very funny. Todd Haynes' latest picture is a deft tonal juggling act, as you'll see anywhere this year. And Poor Things will be out December 8th. Keith Ulick, Yorgos Lanthimos, finally has his Dr. Jekyll and Ms. Hyde. And Brian Tallarico, RogerEbert.com. It can be hysterically funny and incredibly disturbing, sometimes in the same beat. And it's the most visually accomplished film that Lanthimos has made. Those are your reviews. Once again, Poor Things, I'm giving 3.5 Maple Leafs. May, December gets 3 Maple Leafs. Anatomy of a Fall gets 3 Maple Leafs. And Albert Brooks, Defending My Life, 4 Maple Leafs. Now it's time for our special guest.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Well, it's a pleasure bringing Scott Iman right now. His book is called Charlie Chaplin versus America, When Art, Sex, and Politics Collided. It is a terrific book. I encourage you all to go check it out. And it's available now on bookstores. Scott, congrats on making a terrific book.
Thank you. It ain't easy.
Yeah, I can imagine. I mean, Chaplin's a fascinating character, and there's lots to get into. I found this really specifically interesting about his relationship with Buster Keaton. This is a story late in the book you tell. At dinner, Sora began to go on about Keaton, how wonderful he thought he was, a great filmmaker. My father got smaller and smaller in his chair. He was so hurt, it looked as if someone had stabbed him. He became very quiet, didn't say a word through the rest of dinner. Afterwards, we're sitting by the fire and talking about other things now. My father was looking at the fire, still not talking. Then he looked at Carlos in the eyes and said, but I was an artist, and I gave him work. He'd been thinking about it all during dinner. What was that relationship like with Chaplin and Buster Keaton?
Well, it was one of mutual respect. Obviously, Chaplin would never have hired him for Limelight. I mean, clearly. But at the time, Keaton was, in his recovery phase from years of alcoholism, and he was working, but it was mostly in television. And Chaplin didn't watch television because he thought it was terrible. So he didn't really understand that Keaton was not a broken down drunk anymore, that he was actually more or less sober and was working all the time. And the part when he hired Keaton, the sequence began evolving, because when Chaplin saw Keaton and they started thinking and talking about the scene, it began expanding. And what had basically been a kind of a walk-on part became a kind of Twilight of the Gods, a scene between two incredible talents at the tail end of their careers and lives, actually. And it just expanded into a 7 or 8 minute comedy symphony, really, whereas it had been intended as a very brief walk-on kind of thing, almost a guest appearance.
Yeah, amazing to think they were able to collaborate in that respect. His relationship with his wife, significantly younger. This is a beautiful story at the end. When Una boarded a flight to London, a friend noticed she opened her purse and took something out. The friend looked closely and saw that it was one of Charlie's gloves. Una held onto it for the entire flight as if his hand was still inside it.
Yeah, that is a lovely vignette. It was a spectacularly successful marriage from day one, even though everybody thought it was just another one of Charlie's caprices because she was 18 and he was 52 or 53 at the time. But they were together for the rest of his life, idyllically happy. They had 8 children together. And when he died, after, the usual slow diminishment of old age, it was extraordinarily difficult for her because he had been the center of her life, just as she had been the center of his life. And I think the reason the marriage was such a roaring success compared to his other marriages was that for the first time, he'd found someone who gave him absolute acceptance. She didn't want him to be anything other than what he already was. She didn't want to change him. She was absolutely happy with the man she found when she was 18 years old. And in return, he gave her absolute acceptance as well, because she had this catastrophic relationship with her father, Eugene O'Neill, a wonderful writer, god-awful human being, who always, whatever Una did was wrong as far as her father was concerned. She could do no right. So the fact that Chaplin accepted her on her terms and she accepted him on his terms, they basically almost never had a crossword between them, because each of them gave the other what they'd been looking for their entire lives.
That's so sweet to think about. You mentioned Eugene O'Neill. November of 1953, Eugene O'Neill died, supposedly uttering the furious last words, "Born in a hotel room and goddammit, died in a hotel room." O'Neill was as vicious in death as he had been in life. His will contained this provision: "I purposely exclude from any interest under this will my son, Shane O'Neill, my daughter, Una O'Neill Chaplin, and exclude their issue now and hereafter born." Why was he such a nasty cuss?
Well, he was an Irish drunk, and Irish drunks are not noted for their gentle benevolence. He was not a domestic human being. His marriages were bad. His last wife, to whom he was married for a number of years before he died, basically was his caretaker, and was whatever you say, Gene. She capitulated completely, which is what he wanted. Both of his sons were suicides. I suspect Una escaped only because she was lucky enough to marry Chaplin.
Yeah, like you said, great writer. We can focus on a long day's journey tonight and not the kind of person he was, which was obviously reprehensible. There's also stuff, and the sex is in the subtitle of the book. Chaplin, a very promiscuous, active sex life. There's a story about Brooks who's talking about Chaplin, and she thought he the most bafflingly complex man who ever lived. The article did not refer to what Brooks regarded as Chaplin's most bizarre affectation, his habit of painting his genitals with iodine and the belief that it would prevent venereal disease. That and the image of his bright red erection she saved for her friends.
Yeah.
This was a guy who was, especially for that time, his sexual predilections, Moore's habits, whatever you want to call it, definitely unique, right? Stood out?
No, not really. Not if you know anything about American vaudeville or English vaudeville. No. It was a pretty free and easy time. The Marx Brothers were not known for their sobriety when it came to sex, and a lot of the performers. It was a very free and easy environment. You know, you worked with people for a week, and then you wouldn't see them again, maybe ever. You know, so there were a lot of casual hookups, that kind of thing. And unless you were working with husbands and wives, in which case it was more arduous. But the English vaudeville was even more. It was even worse because a lot of the performers were expected to drink with the audience. So there was more of an alcohol factor in England than there was in America, where the performers didn't have to drink with the audience. So English vaudeville was even more promiscuous than American vaudeville was. But you had, on the other hand, the acts had to be crystal clean in America. You know, the Schuberts and the rest of the entrepreneurs who owned the theaters wanted clean acts because they wanted the family audience, because the more people they got, the more money they made. So they wanted the acts clean so people could bring their children. So whatever went on behind the scenes, you know, during off hours or at night, nobody knew about. It was a bipolar sexual era in many respects, not just in the theater, but in America as well.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned the Marx Brothers, because Marx saw Chaplin in vaudeville and told his brothers he was the greatest comedian I'd ever seen and held that opinion for the rest of his life. We were in Salt Lake City, remember, Groucho. We all went to a whorehouse. Chaplin was so shy, the madam of the whorehouse had a dog, and Chaplin sat on the floor, played with the dog all evening. He was too shy to take a girl to bed. 5 years later, though, I came up to see him. He was living at home like Mary Pickford. He invited the boys up to dinner with him, and he had a girl with him, and he was always fucking. Fucked every leading lady, like Chico. Edna Purviance was her name. I tried to fuck her too, but she was a Chaplin. The world went crazy about this guy. So if he was inhibited earlier, he clearly wasn't later on.
Well, he was extraordinarily shy. And like even in later in life, like most comedians, rather than be with someone, he would tend to do bits. You know, he would entertain them because that was his default position. That's every comedian's default position. If they're laughing, they like me, you know? So like most comedians, he would try to make people laugh. He had to really know someone to be able to relax on a social level, you know, and just be with someone and have a conversation. Otherwise, especially with strangers or with people he didn't know very well, he would perform. And because he was extraordinarily talented, nobody complained, because you were seeing Charlie Chaplin do a live performance, which very few people got a chance to see by the time he was in the movies. I love that story because it indicates so much about his character, and because he was extraordinarily shy. And as with most shy people, when he became famous, people approached him. He didn't have to approach anybody. So he was basically, after he became famous, he was standing on third base. Oh, he didn't have to do a lot in order to score. You know, it was the women would come to him, and they would do all the work, really. And all he had to do was be Charlie Chaplin and be charming, or appear to be charming, you know, and the rest was much easier than it had been when he had to walk up to somebody, introduce himself, make conversation, convince them he was charming, convince them of this and convince them of that. And he never really felt like that, because he never really got his poverty, got past the grinding poverty of his early days, you know. He was good looking. He knew he was good looking. He knew he had qualities that were attractive to women. But on the other hand, he was small. And when you grow up poor, that's your self-image. It's inculcated in you, you know, for a long, long time, probably always. And so that was certainly the case with him. For him, money was armor. Money was armor. It was a protection against the vagaries of the world.
I love the baseball analogy. It's well said. His marriage, as you said earlier, the stuff that happened earlier on was nasty. The marriage ended a few years later in a legendarily rancorous divorce. Gray's complaint accused Chaplin of things both factual and fantastic. Seduction of a minor, statutory rape, perversion, adultery, soliciting abortions, and murderous threats. Later on, specified, he solicited, urged, demand that plaintiffs submit to perform and commit such acts and things for the gratification of defendants' said abnormal, unnatural, perverted, and degenerate sexual desires as to be too revolting, indecent, and immoral to set forth in detail in this complaint. How did he deal with this kind of accusations being leveled against him?
He gave her money. I mean, yeah, that was the equivalent of the atomic bomb, that divorce complaint. So basically, he went to New York, hid out for a while, and then settled. He gave her basically almost $1 million, which in 1920, this is 1927, 28, is just a humongous amount of money. Some of it, of course, went to the lawyers. Some of it went to her mother. The rest she blew over time. But, you know, he could not, you didn't want that sort of stuff floating around in the ether indefinitely.
This also report focused on an earlier memo from the chief investigator of the Mann Act prosecution. Along the way, attention had been paid to Charlie Chaplin, King of Tragedy, a biography published in Idaho in 1940. The quoted material focused on more than a dozen women Chaplin had been involved with over the years that made a wild right turn by suggesting that despite voluminous evidence to the contrary, he might be homosexual. In passing, rumor has it that Chaplin is unnatural in his sexual relations, and it has been said that he is a homosexual. In your research, did you discover any of that? Was he gay?
No, not even. I don't even think he ever thought about it. No, he was a raving heterosexual.
So that's the thing. Sometimes some of these cases come out and it can be a little bit difficult. This is another good passage you had. You said propriety could be displaced by whimsy. Michael Powell's a dinner guest at Chaplin's house. And, you know, he's talking about things that are happening here. And just his, I guess, relationship. Chaplin and Dylan Thomas got in a conversation about the pervasive hostility of the press. And Chaplin asked Thomas for some advice. What would you say to them? Well, said Thomas, there's only one thing you could say. Tell them to go fuck their bloody eyelids. What was Chaplin's relationship with the press? Did he take Thomas's advice?
No. He tried to avoid the press whenever possible, especially as the tide turned against him in the 1940s. But nothing he could have done would have made any difference, because when I wasn't even fully aware of this myself when I started to write the book, but the deeper I got into the research process and the more I read, the more clippings I read of the never-ending tidal flow of negative disinformation, almost entirely erroneous and or completely fictional, that permeated the public press for years. And we're talking like 10 years getting hammered on a weekly basis by people like Hedda Hopper and Westbrook Begler and Ed Sullivan and the Hearst papers and the Chicago Tribune papers and the Los Angeles Times syndicate. I mean, it was never ending. And gradually, it poisoned the public well about the subject of Charlie Chaplin.
I love that you included this detail, since I'm an avid tennis fan. Norman Lloyd and Chaplin played tennis 3 or 4 times a week, usually around 5 in the afternoon, after the heat was fading, the cool California night was on the ascent. I know he played a very aggressive game, said Daniel Selznick, the son of David Selznick, who lived by Chaplin. The balls from Chaplin's court regularly landed in the east garden of our house. After we got 10 or 12 balls, I would take them back to his house. Una would come back to the door and thank me. Very aggressive tennis player. I love that aspect you included in there.
Yeah, I was talking to Catherine Weiler a week or so ago, the daughter of William Weiler. And Weiler lived up the street on Summit Drive from Chaplin, a couple doors up. And she told me about the Chaplin-Weiler tennis tournaments that went on for hours, because both Chaplin and Weiler were small men, used to getting their way, alpha males, and they played for blood. You know, neither one would capitulate. Neither one would admit the other one was better. So the games would stretch into twilight, and the kids loved watching. And eventually one of them would win and one of them would lose. And then the wives would come out and Tally Weiler and Una would play, but neither one of them was athletic in the least, and they couldn't play tennis, and the kids would get bored and throw things at their mothers. But they loved watching their fathers play, because they saw aspects of their fathers they didn't see around the house, you know, because Weiler around the house was much more casual than he was on the set or on the tennis court. And Chaplin around the house, when he wasn't working, when he wasn't in his office writing or working on a music score or something, was fairly pleasant as well around the house. But on the tennis court, all laughter ceased.
Love his competitive nature. Again, we're talking with Scott Eyman. The book is called Charlie Chaplin Versus America: When Art, Sex, and Politics Collided. There's obviously a ton of fascinating information about him behind the scenes. But as far as the movies themselves, I'm sure you watched them, researched them, read about them. What are your favorites of Chaplin? Modern Times, Gold Rush?
I love The Kid. I love The Gold Rush. I love City Lights. I love Modern Times. I like The Great Dictator. I am ambivalent about Monsieur Verdoux. I love Limelight. That's about it. I don't make any claims at all for the last two pictures, King of New York and Count of Monte Cristo.
Yeah. What is it about Limelight that you love? Because I haven't seen it, but reading about it, you really paint a vivid portrait of it. Why it was important to Charlie?
Well, it's very autobiographical, directly autobiographical. It's about a comedian who lost his audience. And he's not sure he can be funny anymore. He's not sure he has a place in the world anymore, you know? And it's also the story of Charlie and Una told in dramatic terms. A young girl, he rescues a young girl who falls in love with him. And he doesn't think it's going to work because of the age difference, you know? So it has all these autobiographical elements woven into this portrait of the Edwardian theater that Chaplin grew up in. So it's a memory piece. And at the same time, it's very emotional. And it's very directly autobiographical. So it's got three or four really interesting strands of meaning and emotion going throughout the picture. And it's funny.
Yeah.
And it's sad, too. You should see it.
Yeah, and I definitely want to check it out. I remember the great film critic Jeff Pevere wrote for the Toronto Star, my hometown paper. He wrote about City Lights, and he goes, the ending makes me cry. Right. And it's such a beautiful ending when I watch City Lights. It's funny, but that ending is so beautiful when he actually sees her.
It's one of the great endings in all movies.
Yeah, it really is. For somebody who's young, right? Millennials, somebody, let's say in their 20s, they say, well, Charlie Chaplin, why should I watch Charlie Chaplin? Why should I care about Charlie Chaplin? What would your answer be?
Chaplin's foundational. Without Charlie Chaplin, there's no movie industry, not the way it evolved. Because Chaplin transcended Hollywood in a way that nobody else had or nobody else could. The Tramp was accepted as Japanese in Japan. He was accepted as German in Germany, French in France, English in England. Actually, he basically was English. It was an English construct. And he united all quadrants of the audience in a way nobody else had or could have. Suddenly, the movies became intellectually respectable. And everybody came to see Chaplin movies. The poor people came to see themselves reflected in The Tramp. And rich people came to see the strains of melancholy and grace that it coexisted with the rough house, the slapstick rough house. So he's a foundational figure. And he assumed control of his career within months of starting in the movie business. 3 or 4 months in the movie business, he was directing himself because he was impossible to work with unless he was directing himself, unless he had control. And he moved towards complete control in a way that almost nobody did. He owned his own studio. He financed his own movies after 1918. He had owned 25% of a major releasing organization, United Artists. So he's important in an industrial sense and a creative sense, as well as in a commercial sense. And there are very few people that check all those boxes in the history of the motion pictures. I mean, and also he personified the autocratic remote creator who does exactly as he wants to do. And the audience follows him. And, you know, you can point to Kubrick or Christopher Nolan in the modern era as similar. But Kubrick and Christopher Nolan didn't finance their own pictures. They took money. They took the money from the studios. But Chaplin believed that if you take money from the studio, you're going to have to get their notes. And you're going to have to listen to what they think. And Chaplin was never interested in what anybody else thought, except Charlie Chaplin. So he was a complete autocrat when it came to his work. So for all those reasons, he's eternally relevant.
That's really well said. And the Tramp is such an iconic character. I'm a short man myself. And I remember one time this guy said to me, he goes, you always have so much stuff in your pockets. He says, yeah, he goes, you look like Charlie Chaplin walking around. Like, hey, that's a compliment, man. You're comparing me to Charlie Chaplin, the little Tramp. I'll grow a little mustache, put a hat on. It's good stuff. Scott Eyman is the author, Charlie Chaplin versus America, When Art, Sex, and Politics Collided. It's a fabulous book. You should all read it. Scott, can't thank you enough for the time. I really appreciate it.
Happy to do it anytime.
Once again, thanks to Scott. Make sure you check out the book. I hope everybody has an incredible Thanksgiving. I saw people tweeting saying that how much me and Chris always talk about Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. So those aren't pillows. Hopefully you'll get a chance to watch it. No bigger fan than Chris's mom, right? She's
her favorite movie.
Steve Martin, John Candy. No one did it better. Thanks so much for listening to Cinephile. I believe 300 episodes in the books, maybe 300 more. Next week, special guest, Lisa Cortez, Oscar-nominated, Emmy-winning producer, director of Little Richard, I Am Everything, and a whole lot of movies. I'm getting all the screeners emailed to me now, so we're talking at least 4 movies a week. Thanks for listening. I'll continue to dominate Samson, and I'll see you at the movies.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Everyone is talking about magnesium. It's all you hear about. But why? What do we know about magnesium? Well, magnesium is the number one mineral that 75% of Americans are deficient in. If you are a woman over 35, magnesium will help you rediscover balance, energy, and vitality. Magnesium supports more than 300 enzymatic reactions in your body, including those involved in hormonal balance. From functional medicine doctors to mental well-being and female hormone experts, we all know that magnesium is the one mineral to improve all aspects of well-being and health. But which one? Magnesium Breakthrough from Bioptimizers, the trusted choice recommended by leading experts, with 7 best-absorbed forms of magnesium to ensure your body receives the support it needs for overall well-being. Go to bioptimizers.com/balance today and use code BALANCE10 for 10% off. Support your journey to wellness at bioptimizers.com/balance. Magnesium Breakthrough from Bioptimizers, your foundation to optimal health and vitality.